Blog Talk Radio.
How you doing today? This is Cliff. You know, I've been posting quite a few galleries from Cusco on the Facebook page, and there's just so much to cover when it comes to Cusco or some of the surrounding areas in that region of Peru. And I've started selecting individual photographs to put up, and the ones that I want to note are those that are from Jesus Gamarra. And we interviewed Jesus last year, and he is without a doubt one of the most authoritative people on the various stoneworks in Cusco, along with Jan-Peter de Jong, who we also had on the program, who's a Dutch researcher. But I want to bring to attention a series of these images that are just mind-blowing. And I posted a few earlier in the week, starting from Tuesday the 19th all the way up until, let's see, the most recent one is the 20th. And what's amazing is, and we've talked about this before, are the methods of rock cutting, rock molding in these images. And when I say rock molding, it looks like there was a technology. And by the way, this is these period pieces. These are period pieces. The period they were constructed by is referred to as Hanan Pacha, or the First World work, and it's estimated that these are between 40 and 50,000 years old. Now, that's not based on any scientific evidence. It's based on Alberto Gamarra, Jose's father, Jesus's father, estimating the work based on a timeline that he developed. But anyhow, wow, if it is 50,000 years old, it's mind-blowing. But what happens when you see these, what appears to happen when you see this is someone took an extremely hot tool, and when I describe them, it's like a trowel-like tool, like you're troweling cement, and pushes up the rock in such a way that it leaves these huge marks, huge trowel marks, or pushed into stone marks. And I have two of these photographs. One is of a round rock. The round rock one is, the title is, I'm looking at it right now, Example of Unknown Technology Applied to Solid Rock, Hanan Pacha style. Notice how the stone is pushed upwards in a single large stroke, like troweling cement. That's what I'm reading right off of the caption. But this and the other photograph are very unusual in that they were able to manipulate solid rock in such a way as to trowel it, to move it, to shape it, to form it in geometric shapes and in very very relaxed kind of motion shapes where you're using a trowel that are mind-blowing. It just doesn't make any sense to us currently because we have no way to do that. So anyhow, this is one of these lost technologies series that I've posted. And you can see it all on Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. And wow, it's very, very interesting. And I appreciate Jose posting that for us. As always, I suggest people go to the Facebook page to see these images, because I'm selecting them from other people's galleries, but also people submit galleries every single day, and I have to be somewhat selective. But when these guys, these experts send me photographs, it's really an opportunity to see a science that we just don't know about, and an application of technology we just don't know about. It's really fascinating. So check those out. And as always, check out Facebook each week to see what's going on. So my guest today, and the subject this week is author, King Arthur and the Round Table. And you're kind of going, well, you know, what's that all about? Well, my guest today, Graham Phillips, is a former journalist, BBC broadcaster, and he's an historical investigator. And he has written some very fascinating books, 13 in total, including The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant, Merlin and the Discovery of Avalon in the New World, the End of Eden, just a couple. He lives in England, and his books are so valued by the residents of the UK, England, that many times these people will go out to these locations and start digging around and asking for more information from the local authorities. And I just finished this interview a short while ago, and so Graham is extremely busy. Of course, the Queen, we know, yesterday just turned 90, and England is all in celebration of this historic date. Very long-lived monarchs over there, I have to say. I think that her mother, according to Graham, Elizabeth's mother lived to be 100. So that's quite fabulous. So anyhow, have a listen to this, and I will come back at the end, and we will touch base about our following guest. Thanks. The story of King Arthur and his fabled Camelot Knights of the Round Table have always been a fascination for countless decades, for ages. And a number of different people have written about Arthur and his various adventures. His sword, known as the Excalibur, has always been quite interesting. And, I mean, there's been animated movies. Disney did an animated piece. And countless movies have been made about the Knights of the Round Table. What an amazing fable is what we all thought, until my guest today spent the better part of 25 years researching and investigating this so-called fable, and has come up with what it really looks like, some startling evidence for a factual author, that he would potentially be a real person. It just is fascinating. And my guest today, Graham Phillips, is not only a fabulous writer, but he has written a number of books related to this period, this medieval period. And today we're going to talk about his newest book, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, The Search for Camelot in the Isle of Avalon. Graham, welcome to the program.
Hello. Pleased to be on.
I got to tell you, I've read a good section of this book, and your research is quite uncanny. You say you spent 25 years researching it. Was that indirectly as you're writing your other books, or is it one of those things where you kind of find a piece of evidence and kind of capture it and then put it away for later? Is that the kind of research you're talking about, or are you talking about hardcore field research evidence for the writing of this fabulous book?
Well, it's a bit of both, really. It wasn't done, the research, all the time, every waking moment. I mean, I'd do something for a few months, and then it would come to a dead end. So I would have to sort of leave that, go on to investigate something else for another book, perhaps, and then a bit later on, something else would come up, and then I'd work on that. So it's kind of on and off for 25 years. But the reason it's taken that amount of time isn't so much that the evidence was there, but I couldn't find it. It was the evidence was there, but it hadn't surfaced because, for example, the archaeological discoveries hadn't been made at that time to move on to the next point. So I had to wait for archaeology to dig in various places and develop the kind of technology that could discover more about Arthur's period of history before I could move on to the next step.
Hmm. You know, it's funny because the Middle Ages are very difficult to research just because it's a period where a lot of writing isn't done, sketchy, and it's one of the worst periods in our recorded history, simply, and that's why it's called the Dark Ages. Can you now reliably say there was a true author based on your work? I mean, were you able to piece together this story to unveil this guy?
I think I can say that I've taken it further than anyone else, and you'll see in a moment when I explain what the evidence is that that it is pretty convincing, if I say so myself. But you're absolutely right when you say the period of the Dark Ages, which is when the Roman Empire collapsed in the mid to late 400s, up until the time of knights in shining armor, is a period when you've got Vikings invading Britain and you've got Anglo-Saxons invading. Everybody thinks of the English as Anglo-Saxons, but back in Roman times, the Britons were Celts. And then the Saxons and the Angles, who came from Germany, invaded the country in the late 400s, early 500s, and then later the Vikings came and invaded. So with all these wars going on, the native British people were in a state of pretty much anarchy most of the time. And during this period, very few records were written, and those that were written have hardly survived. And unless books are kept in dry conditions in a climate like Britain, which it rains all the time, they're going to be ruined over time. And it wasn't until the later Middle Ages, the medieval period, when they started building great big cathedrals and abbeys, that there were places where books could be kept dry and so survive. So the main reason why it's so difficult, as you pointed out, to investigate the Dark Ages is because so little was written or has survived. And Arthur is said to have lived around the year 500 AD, which is smack bang in the middle of this period where it was worse off than at any other time before or since. So that's why he's remained such a mystery.
Yeah. No, it's funny because you describe, and your research is wonderful, you describe a 9th century British monk called Nennius, and in his book called The History of the Britons, which, boy, it sounds like a fascinating book, but you were able to actually extract from his, I guess you would call it a period piece, for lack of a better word, information on this period where Arthur did live. Why is his book so important in your research?
Well, the main reason is because most of the stories about Arthur that have created the legend we know today, with Camelot, Excalibur, Arthur rescuing damsels in distress and all this sort of thing, were written about from around about the year 1150 onwards. And they were, a lot of those stories were fictional, based on earlier legends of King Arthur. And so obviously they do contain a number of completely unbelievable things. So left most historians thinking that, well, this man who fought dragons and rescued damsels in distress couldn't have lived. But there were earlier stories about King Arthur that survived that aren't so well written, but are still legendary. But he's depicted more in a kind of historical context. But the earliest reference to King Arthur that tells us anything about him at all, which was written a good few centuries before these romantic tales of the Middle Ages were written, was, as you say, by this monk called Nennius. He lived or wrote around 830 AD, and he wrote a history of Britain He was the first person since the Romans left, well, one of the first people anyway, to try and put together a history of Britain. Mm-hmm. And records were scant at the time, but he was able to go to monasteries and abbeys that existed during his time, collect records, and as he calls it, heat them together in the best way that he could in order to try and create a history of the Britons. And in this manuscript, which survives at the British Library in London, he refers to Arthur and he refers to him existing at the same time as the later romantic stories say he existed around 500 AD. He says he was a man who fought against the invading Anglo-Saxons from Germany and that he was remarkably successful. All he does, though, however, is talk about Arthur as a warrior, the leader of the Britons, and he talks about him defeating the Saxons in 12 decisive battles. Now, he talks about him in a matter-of-fact way as an historical figure, then moves on to something else. There's no elaboration, no flights of fancy, no, you know, none of this sort of thing there. He's written about him in a historical way. And he says he got these records about Arthur from monastic records that still survived. And what's really interesting is he refers to historical events around the time of Arthur that we know from other sources that have survived were real events. The Anglo-Saxons, for example, kept their own records and talk about one of their first kings being called Hengist. And we know that when he died, his son Octher took over. And this was sometime in the 490s. Mm-hmm. Nennius, however you want to pronounce his name, he tells us that Arthur became the leader of the Britons when Hengist died and his son Octher took over as leader of the Anglo-Saxons. Mm-hmm. He also tells us that Arthur's greatest battle, when he defeated the Saxons and pushed them almost out of the country, but not quite, was a battle at a place called Badon. Now, we know from a monk who wrote within living memory at the time Arthur is said to have existed that Badon was a genuine historical battle in which the Britons defeated the Saxons, although this monk Nennius, who was alive at the same time as the period Arthur is said to have lived, Gildas, the earlier monk, he actually doesn't tell us who was the leader at the time of the Battle of Badon. So the leader of the most important decisive victory of the period Arthur is said to have lived remains a mystery. And the first person to actually tell us who that leader was is Nennius. So in other words, Nennius's book is a good historical document mm-hmm. for telling us that Arthur was a real historical figure.
Well, let me ask you about Nennius. Now, does he only describe the battles that this king is involved in, or does he get into more specifics about the birth of or a family tree that this author might have been under? Is that how you were able to kind of focus on that, or is it more that you put the pieces together related to these battles, and then it relates to other investigative research that kind of patches it all together?
Well, to start off with, that Nennius doesn't really tell us anything more about Arthur than these battles. He didn't tell us where he came from. He doesn't tell us where he was born or where he died or anything like this. Uh-huh. So that kind of got me stuck. And it was only later. Remember I mentioned this other monk called Gildas, mm-hmm. who wrote within living memory of the time Arthur lived, in exactly the year 545, in fact. So remember, he talks about the Battle of Badon, in which the Britons were victorious over the Saxons, although he doesn't tell us who the British leader was. But he does say who the most important British leader was at this period. But he doesn't refer to him as Arthur. He refers to him as the bear, Ursus in Latin, which is the language in which he wrote. Ursus the bear. Now, at first I thought, I must say is that a lot of people at that time, a lot of warriors, were given the names, the honorary names, titles, if you like, of animals to somehow represent their prowess in battle. The wolf, the hound, the eagle, and so forth. And this warrior was called the bear. But he doesn't actually tell us what his real name was. But when I it was just by accident one time, I thought, I wonder what bear, the word for bear was in Brythonic, which was the language spoken in Britain during the Dark Ages. And I looked it up, and the word for a bear was Arth, A-R-T-H.
Oh, that's funny.
And it still survives in modern Welsh, which derived from that language. And I thought, what? The man who was the most powerful leader in the country at the time Arthur is said to have existed was actually had a title called Arth. But maybe that could easily have turned into Arthur in a Latinized form. I thought, wow, I'm really onto something here. And that's what set me off trying to identify who this man, the bear, was, where he came from.
Okay, that's fascinating. But I have to tell you, there is a section in your book where Nennius reveals this real-life leader known as Owen Dengwyn. And I might be butchering the name, but this is the figure that appears to be the true individual who becomes author, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about this individual, Owen.
Yes, well, to try and find out who the bear was, there was a document in the British Library. It wasn't actually written by Nennius, but it's in the same manuscript. It's bound up in the same manuscript, so it comes at the end of Nennius's description, and it talks of Arthur and other British events. And it's a series of genealogies, family trees, of the rulers of Britain. And it identifies who this person, the bear, was. And as you say, his name was Owen, I think they pronounce it Fangwin.
Fangwin, D-D-A-N-T. Yeah.
G-W-Y-N. It's D-D. That's it. D-D-A-N-T-G-W-Y-N.
Fangwin. Pronounce it one more time.
Owen Fangwin.
Fangwin.
He's in Brythonic and in modern Welsh, a double D together is pronounced. They didn't. Nobody invented the T and the H together, even in English until the Middle Ages. They used to have an actual letter for T and H in English that looked a bit like a Y, which has led to the mistaken belief that people used to speak ye olde English. It was never ye. It was always the. It's just that this Y type let shape thing represented the TH sound. But in Old Brythonic, it was a double D. So his actual birth name was Owen Fangwin. And he inherited the battle or battle name or title, the Bear, or Arth, when he became king in the 490s. Now, this is exactly when Nennius tells us that Arthur's kicking around, so it would seem to be the same person. But okay, his name's not Arthur, it's Arth. It could have become Arthur in later renditions. But I needed to find out more about where he lived and discovered that the capital where he held court was an old Roman city called Viriconium, right in the center of England.
Hmm. Wow. The battles that he undertakes are basically, you're going to give us a little history here. During this period in time, the tribes were trying to invade what was left of the Roman civilization as it was failing. And these battles are against these nomads and the paganistic groups that were, I guess he fought in France and into regular Europe, but he also fought these battles in England, which was ultimately his demise. But these battles are somewhat famous, or are they just battles to keep the memory of Roman occupation alive?
No, the battles were famous. What actually happened? I mean, some of the battles have been forgotten, some of them recorded by the Anglo-Saxons if they won, some were recorded by other people. The thing is that Britain, after the Romans left, faced invasion on three fronts. Imagine any country, suddenly all the army and the police disappear from the streets. It's going to be anarchy. It's going to be something like what happened in Yugoslavia after the collapse of communism.
Yeah.
And those civil wars go on. When the Romans left Britain, the central administration collapsed. There was anarchy. Separate little kingdoms sprang up all over the place. And then Britain started facing invasion on three fronts. You've got the Anglo-Saxons from Germany, as I've mentioned. You've got the Picts, who are a Celtic people from the north of Britain in what's now Scotland. And you've got the Irish raiders coming across the Irish Sea and raiding the west of Britain. So you've got this kind of invasion on three fronts. But the most serious of these invaders was the Anglo-Saxons in the east of Britain. Now, what happened were the three largest cities in Britain were London, or Londinium, as the Romans called it, Lincoln and York, which were all big cities in the east of Britain. Now, these were all overtaken by the Anglo-Saxons,
mm-hmm.
Now, which forced the Britons to move further west. The fourth biggest city in the country then became the remaining capital of early Dark Age Britain. Now, this was right in the middle of England, what's now England, and it was called Viriconium, a Roman city, which was exactly the city that this man Arth, Owen Thangwyn, ruled from. So, in other words, you've got a character called Arth. You've got him ruling from the most sophisticated city in the country at exactly the time that King Arthur is said to have ruled from the capital of Britain.
Hmm.
Could it be anybody else but Arthur? Surely Owen Thangwyn was one and the same.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Let's talk about this Viriconium. Where is it located in present-day England? Is it close to London or is it out in the someplace else?
London is in the southeast of England, and this is about 150 miles to the northwest of London, mm-hmm. pretty much smack bang in the middle of Britain. The nearest, it's kind of halfway between the cities of Manchester and Birmingham, which are two of the other big cities in England.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 3 miles outside a town called Shrewsbury, and it's literally in open countryside. There's a little tiny village next to it, but it's an open countryside, and it's an open ruin. Now, the other big cities of Roman Britain that I talked about are all now modern cities. The old Roman city of London is buried beneath the streets of modern London. It's under office blocks and extruded apartment buildings and streets,
right.
Whereas this city of Viriconium, what's so amazing about it is when it was eventually abandoned, 100 or so years after the period Arthur is said to have lived, it was just left. No new city was built on top of it. And so consequently, right up until the modern day, its ruined walls still survive.
Yes.
And so it's allowed for archaeologists to excavate the whole area and come up with a complete history of it, of the period that Arthur is said to have existed, so we know exactly what was going on there at the time.
Hmm. Now, did he inherit the rule of the city, or did he actually construct this city?
The city was originally constructed by the Romans, but when the Romans left in the early 400s, it sort of fell into sort of disrepair. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Roman towns throughout Britain were abandoned in this period of warfare and civil strife. And what happened was that the native peoples took to building fortifications on top of hills, hill forts as they were called, which are easily defended. The Roman towns, although they were walled, needed proper trained armies like the Romans had to defend them. Mm-hmm. And once they'd gone, they weren't really very easily defendable. So over a few decades after the Romans left, most of the big towns of the Romans were abandoned. But Viriconium continued to be occupied. And what's incredible, the archaeological excavations that have taken place over the last 25 years have shown that exactly around the year 500 AD, Viriconium was rebuilt and massively refortified. Mm-hmm. And new streets were laid, new defences, and right in the centre of the city, there was a new palace built. What it's said to have been one of the last classical Roman-style buildings ever to be built in Britain for another 1,000 years until the Renaissance.
Yes.
And it's here that archaeologists believe, because of the rebuilding, because of this palace that was created, it was the seat of an extraordinarily important warlord. Well, there you've got further evidence that somebody of great importance and great might must have been involved in refortifying the capital city of Britain at the time. It is the same time as we know that somebody united the Britons to start booting out the Anglo-Saxons for a while, because archaeological evidence has shown that they were pushed back. We also have the work of Gildas, the monk who wrote Within Living Memory, who tells us that the Anglo-Saxons are beaten at the Battle of Badon, which Nennius later repeats. So you put all this together, somebody of extreme importance united the Britons. That person was living at Viriconium. And we know historically that that person was Owen Llanfairpwll. He must have been the bloke who, you know, the man who rebuilt the place and refortified it. And his name, battle name, was Arth. He's doing everything Arthur does at exactly the same time as Arthur is said to have done it.
Fabulous.
From the archaeological point of view and the historical documentation point of view, I'm convinced I've identified who Arthur really was and where he came from.
It's amazing. Now, is there any data on this being the same area that would have the round table, the knights of the round table, and his, of course, if he's what they consider a warlord, that would make sense that he would train and make knights for his battles, right?
Yeah, they weren't called knights in those days, or at least they weren't knights in the sense that you would imagine them with the plate armor, the shining armor, horses, lances, and jousting. That didn't exist until about many hundreds of years later. Mm-hmm. He would have been more like a Roman-style warrior. The armor would have been Roman type of armor.
Right.
And rather than living in a huge Gothic castle, he'd have lived in wooden fortified stockades, and there would have been brick buildings, but that'd have been more like Roman buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the round table idea, remember this man, Owen Llanfairpwll, is a Roman style Briton. He's half Celt, half Roman citizen, if you like, or at least the Romans had gone, but he would have been a Roman citizen if they'd still been there. So he's kind of a combination of both. And they still, the Celtic practice of when a warrior, a chieftain or a king, met with his leading warriors, who weren't called knights, but, you know, whatever they were, his leading warriors, the tradition was they sat in a circle so that no one could be seen to be sitting at the head of the group. So they were all kind of share, they were all equal.
Oh,
now this,
yeah.
I believe it's this tradition of them sitting in a circle, whether it was round a table or not, that brought about the legend of the round table. There is actually a round table that's said to have belonged to Arthur that hangs on the wall of a castle down in Winchester in the south of England, but that's been shown to have been, you know, carbon dating has shown that to have been a medieval fake. But I do believe that the idea that I'm sitting in this circle is where that idea came from.
Hmm. I have to ask you, I want to back up just a little bit. If Owen Llanfairpwll was trained in the Roman military, wouldn't they have, because they took pretty good documents, wouldn't they have something that showed that here was a one-time, I don't know if he was a Roman general or, I mean, there's different ranks within the Roman army who slowly came up and became this fighter, this to vanquish the Celts from Europe and from England. What, wouldn't there be some record or what? I mean, how do you explain his position as this fighter, this as you call it, a warmonger? Did he have a rank that we know about?
He was actually called the Dus Bellorum, which means leader of battles. Hmm. But to understand how he got to that position, one has to remember, firstly, that the Roman Empire in the West, the Roman Empire as we know it, finally and totally collapsed in the mid-470s. The last of the Roman emperors, there was a little boy called Romulus Augustulus, who's basically was just put there by some general who decided to make him a puppet emperor. He was his palace was stormed in Rome by the German Goths, and the Visigoth king made himself king of Italy and locked the little boy away under house arrest until he died and basically took over Italy. And that was the end of the Roman Empire. Now, this is about 20 years before the period that Arthur appears on the scene. But in Britain at the time, we do have a few records that survive then. And then gradually over the next few years, the records get less and less as Roman influence totally disappears. Mm-hmm. The Romans had already left the army had left Britain way before, but there's just no Roman Empire left at all at the end of the 400s. There's a man appears on the scene called Ambrosius Aurelius. Now, he is mentioned by this monk Gildas, who wrote in 454 and 545. Gosh, it's complicated with all these dates and others. And he was the first, the last of the Roman sort of leaders of Britain. He wasn't actually, he seems to have come over from France as a kind of, as the German forces eventually took over what was left of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. A contingent of the last of the Roman soldiers seems to have fled to Britain, led by this man, Ambrosius Aurelius. Now, we know from the records that his father was a Roman consul. That means a leading figure in Rome. And that he was descended from a Roman emperor called Marcus Aurelius, who is the good emperor at the beginning of the film Gladiator. The one with Russell Crowe, he's there. The good emperor is murdered by his son, and then the whole film starts. That good emperor was the historical Marcus Aurelius, and this Ambrosius Aurelius was like a great great grandson of him or whatever. So he was quite a pretty high ranking Roman citizen. He came to Britain to sort of help with the fight against these invading Saxons and everybody, and put together the first resistance. He was probably the first guy to, well, one of the first people to start rebuilding Viriconium. And then something happens to him, he dies or whatever, we don't know, he disappears from history. And that's where we've got this gap, because the Roman Empire is really gone. And for a long time, there's no records being kept, only the occasional one here and there. And this is the real Dark Ages. So we don't exactly, there's no record of who replaced Ambrosius Aurelius. But we know from the genealogies, the family trees, that Owen Thangwyn is next ruling from Viriconium. So it's obviously him. So I can only say that Owen Thangwyn, although a native Briton, must have been a lieutenant or some general, or I don't know, some rank, high rank in the army of Ambrosius Aurelius, and that is why he took over when he left, and that's where Arthur comes in.
Okay, fabulous. One of the big aspects of the fable of Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table is this fabulous sword, Excalibur, that is all over the story. Is that something that you discovered as part of his legacy, or is that more written in to romanticize the whole Arthurian story?
Well, having discovered that there was a real King Arthur, I thought, well, okay, was he just some boring guy who fought battles, or were some of these fabulous tales really based on the truth, you know? Yeah. I mean, was I going to be responsible for taking this magical character from British history, from world history, and replacing them with some boring warrior who just cut people's heads off? So I started looking into some of the myths and legends, and the Excalibur one, which I thought was going to be basically a completely made-up medieval yarn, turned out to be one of the most likely to have been based on some kind of historical fact.
Huh.
Going back to the period when Arthur is said to have lived, the tradition was that a king or a leading general, their symbol of office wasn't a crown as it was in later times. It was their sword. And so you'd have a sword specially made to denote the fact that you were head of a Roman legion, say, and then that would be handed on to your successor and so forth. Well, the British kings or the British chieftains in the post-Roman period adopted this same tradition and had a sword made to show who the chieftain was. And when that chieftain died, the sword would be handed over to them. So swords are as important as crowns were to the later medieval kings. Mm. And that's sort of the significance of Excalibur, if you like, in reality, probably. Now, the thing was that the Celts had a practice that's been proven, A, by the fact the Romans wrote about it, and B, by the fact that archaeologists have found evidence for it, that when a soldier, a warrior, was dying, his sword, and this was not the king's sword because it had to be handed on, but an ordinary warrior, his sword would be then handed on to, the sword would be taken and thrown into a lake, a sacred lake or pool, as an offering to a water goddess. And if you'd become Christianized at that point, the water goddess would be replaced by a saint. Mm-hmm. So you were making an offering to a saint or a goddess. And this actual practice of throwing things into lakes or pools as offerings as became the Romans took that on as well. And it's where we get the tradition of wishing wells from even today, where people throw money.
I was thinking about that, yeah. Yeah.
And many dried up lakes and pools have been found from the period of the Dark Ages with all sorts of items, precious items, including coins and jewelry that have been thrown into these lakes as offerings, votive offerings, as they're called. But they include a great many swords. So we know that this practice took place. Now, the story is that when Arthur goes, there's a civil war, the country falls apart. His sword is not going to be handed on to anybody because his nephew in the legend takes over from him and the country falls apart and that's it. We know that shortly after the period Arthur is said to have lived, the Anglo-Saxons were on the offensive again. So let us say that this man, Owain Llanguin, is dying. The country's falling apart. He decides, or his successors decide, that this sword isn't going to be handed on to anyone else. We don't want fighting about it. If anyone else gets a sword, there'll be more fighting about it. Mm-hmm. So they decide for this sword to be thrown into a lake, as is the normal funerary practice for an ordinary warrior. Or maybe the king himself decides that. So the idea of his sword being thrown into a lake in the legend, and then the arm of the Lady of the Lake, a mysterious water nymph, catches the sword and takes it down into the crystal depths,
yeah,
then that is probably an exaggeration, a legend that built up from a real funerary practice of Arthur's sword being thrown into a sacred pool as a funerary offering.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So what I thought was perhaps the most peculiar and unlikely of the stories seems to have been based on some kind of historical fact.
That's fabulous. Wow. And I can imagine in England, there are literally thousands and thousands of battle swords hanging in museums and private collections. That piece of information is fabulous. Just to think about the possibilities of a sword from Arthur being immortalized in some way.
Well, I tried to find out where it might have been thrown. Remember I said there was these dried up lakes which had swords and things that had been found by archaeologists.
Right.
I thought if I could find out where Arthur was buried, where this historical figure, Owain Llanguin, was buried, I might be able to find a lake into which his sword was thrown. And that maybe even get some way of having some underwater archaeology to try and find it. Now, the oldest description of Excalibur anywhere, it may be made up, but it is the oldest one on record, describes it as having a hilt made of gold and having two intertwined serpents on it. Now, we know that that was a symbol for a Roman legion that occupied Viriconium, this city at the center of England, before Arthur's time. So it's very likely that that's a genuine description of a sword that Arthur got hold of, perhaps from his predecessor, Ambrosius Aurelius. That could still survive. Gold is not going to rot. That's why it's so precious. Well, also because it's very rare. But so that could still exist at the bottom of the lake, especially preserved under the mud. It could be in pristine condition, the hilt of it anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought, wow, you know, I've got to find this lake. There's a poem that was written in about 650 by a a woman, a princess called Helith, who lived at Viriconium just before it was finally invaded by the Anglo-Saxons. Her husband is a great-great-great-grandson of Owain Tham Gwyn. And, she's a descendant. Her brother is the king, sorry. So she's a direct descendant of the man who I believe was Arthur.
Okay.
When this town, the city of Viriconium, was overtaken by the Anglo-Saxons, the Celts were forced to flee, and they fled west into what is now the Welsh Mountains in the west of Britain. The king, the brother of Helith, was buried at a nearby Viriconium. And in this poem that she wrote, which was a war poem, which is a normal practice at the time for people to write poetry about, if it survived anyway, about the great king's burial, a kind of dirge. And she talks about exactly where he's buried. And she says that this king is buried in a place is called the Churches of Bassa, and that he is buried alongside all his predecessors. In other words, all the kings that had ruled from Viriconium had been buried at this Churches of Bassa. So I thought, wow, is there anything called that? There's nowhere still called the Churches of Bassa anywhere near Viriconium, but about 10 miles away to the northwest, there's a place called Bass Church. Churches of Bassa? Bass Church? I thought, it's got to be the same place. There's nowhere, anywhere in the country with a name anything like it.
Yeah.
And for it to be so near. And when I got there, Bass Church is now a village. Just outside of it is a earthwork. It's a fortified hillock, a good few acres in size. And next to it, another smaller hillock, again fortified with embankments, which has had a certain amount of archaeological work done there, which has shown that it was occupied and being used for some purpose, probably ceremonial rather than defensive, around the year 500.
Let me stop you right there. When you say an earthwork, are you talking about one of the mounds that are now, when you go look at them, they're like covered in green. They're like a artificial hill, right?
Sort of, except, okay, the actual main earthwork, right, the main part of this complex is a real hill, not an artificial one, okay. A real hill, much bigger than any artificial burial mound or anything.
Okay.
It's like, I don't know, sort of 10 acres in size if you look down from it from the top, and about, 300 or 400 feet high or something. It's a real hill, but it stands on a kind of open plain. What's happened at some time in the past is somebody has built defensive earthworks around it, a couple of rings of earth banks that would have been about 10 feet high that would probably have had stockades on the around the top. So it was defended. There's then a kind of causeway, which is a kind of raised bank area, which joined that to another smaller little hillock, which is about an acre in size, which also had this embankments built round it and ditches. Now, going back to the Dark Ages, that whole area was surrounded by water. It was an island or two separate islands connected together.
Right.
And the water levels have dropped over the years, and the land has been has been drained for farming and so forth. But it is on those two islands together, which would have been, are known to archaeologists collectively as the Birth, which basically comes from an old Brythonic word meaning the beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, archaeology had shown that this was actually some of these diggings, these earthworks around this hillocks were built during the period Arthur is said to have lived. So we know that it was being used for something. It is the only site anywhere near Bass Church that fits the description of the Churches of Bassa, the burial site of the kings from Viriconium. So this, I was sure, was the place that was said in this poem by Helith, the descendant of Arthur, to be where all the kings were buried, including Arthur himself, the first of them, or the second, maybe.
Wow.
Do you see what I mean? So
that's fabulous.
I think I've identified the place where Arthur was buried. Now, it was on an island, or two islands connected together, in the middle of a lake, and Arthur, in the romance period in the Middle Ages was said to have been buried on the Isle of Avalon. He sailed to an island. It didn't say it's across the sea. A lot of them seem to suggest it's in a lake. And it's into this same lake that this sword Excalibur is thrown. And I thought, wow, some of the parts of the lake around one of these hillocks, the largest of them, still survives. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wouldn't it be fantastic to organize a marine archaeological scan of that lake to actually see what is there?
Yes.
And so that's what I decided to do next.
Okay, and hello. What?
I thought I'd just leave it at that point.
Well, your book's filled with wonderful references, and actually, you show a picture of a. I guess she's a archaeologist driving a boat with some scanning equipment on the helm or the dashboard. I know we don't want to give the whole book away. Because you are very thorough in your discussion, but can you tell us, were you able to find anything of a significance with these scans? And that was a big question I had, is this earthworks, is if they had gone with any scanning technology and scanned it to see if anyone was buried within it, because it seems to me that you've made a pretty profound discovery here.
Yes, well, what I did was no, I don't mind talking about this at all. The
okay,
the lady
good.
You talk about in the boat. What I did was to organize I got archaeologists and historians interested in really properly looking at that area. I managed to get the funding for it and everything.
Wow.
To make sure that they could do a proper scan. Now it started with the lady in the boat. Now her name is Ruth, and she's she's from Liverpool University in England, and she's a forensic marine archaeologist.
Okay.
And so her job is looking for things hidden under the water. So she has a boat with all this scanning equipment on there, radar and sonar and things I don't understand. She then sweeps the lake, going up and down this lake, because it's a pretty large lake, has a computer readout of what lies underneath. Now, she can set the settings. It's more sophisticated than your ordinary metal detector or something.
Yeah.
It can work out what types of metal there are hidden at the bottom of the lake. And there was a lot of rusty old stuff down there, probably farm implements and things and bedsteads and tires that had been thrown in or whatever. But she found that there seemed to have been something that was of particular interest. She couldn't tell certainly if it was gold or not, but she said it was a particularly interesting reading close to the center of the lake, that it could be an artifact of some type, possibly a sword. But of course, we wouldn't know until the divers went down. So they got a team of divers, underwater archaeologists, who went down. And I thought, wow, we're going to come up with something. This is amazing. But when they came back up, they said, it's just impossible. It's too murky. The water is totally peat stained. And at the bottom, you've got a kind of 6-foot layer of sediment and muck mud that's built up over the solid surface. But they said you'd literally need dredging equipment to be able to get down and find out what it is.
Yeah.
So there it stays. So I tried that one. I looked for Excalibur. It's also possible, of course, that Excalibur could lie on some of the dried up areas of that lake.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't got round to that part yet, because I thought the next thing we must do, now I've got these archaeologists together, is to have an actual scan, like you suggested, of the hillocks themselves in the middle, what was the islands, to see if there was anything buried there.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a team of geophysicists together, and there was four of them altogether. One used ground-penetrating radar. Another one used something called a magnetometer. Another one used something called a resistivity meter. What these things do together when combined, they produce computer-generated images of what lies buried beneath the ground, beneath the soil. And they scanned the whole of this, one of these island areas, which seemed to be the place that I considered where Arthur was buried. And right in the, based on the poem itself saying that one of the first kings was buried somewhere called Travail's Acre. And the one island is like 10 acres and the smaller island is about an acre. So if Trevelyan's Acre was anywhere, it was going to be in this smaller one. Now, that doesn't say all the kings were buried there, but it suggests the first one was. Now, as Ambrosius Aurelius wasn't a king himself, but Owen Thangwyn seems to have been the first king of Viriconium, that seems to be where he was buried. The only way to find out is to do a geophysics scan, and the geophysics scan showed that right in the middle of this acre area, there was what appeared to be a circular pit that had been dug and then filled in, about 6 feet across and 6 feet deep. Exactly the kind of burial pits that they had 1,500 years ago. And in the middle of it, the equipment wasn't sensitive enough to be able to pick up delicate, fragile remains of bones at that depth. Mm-hmm. But it found that there was an iron object in the middle of the pit. And at that time, warriors were often buried with their weapons, usually a shield. And they believe that it could have been the central boss, the central part of a shield that would have been lying on top of the body. So it's got all the signs of being a burial site consistent with the period that Arthur is said to have lived. And this, of course, confirms the poem that said that the first king, i.e. Owen Thangwyn, was buried at that site. So he's there. All we've got to do now is dig him up.
Oh my God, what an amazing bit of research. Is it, I guess you have to get licenses and permission from the local landowners to start digging in their property. But oh my God, if you were able to uncover the remains of this Arthur, wonderful, Orwin.
Owen Thangwyn Arthur, the historical Arthur, the man whose name was Arth.
Yeah.
The thing is, it's not so much the landowners. I mean, even if the landowners would allow permission, I mean, presumably if you pay them enough, they'll let you dig it up. It's like a farm. They don't want people wandering over the land. In fact, they'd probably be happier if somebody did dig it up and be done with it, because people will stop wandering across the fields to have a look at it and leaving the fences open, so gates open, so all the cows get out.
Yeah.
But it's a protected monument because it's known to be, and has been known for some time, to have been a monument of considerable interest that dates back 1,500 years. The government, the department of the British government called English Heritage, has authority over it and has made it a protected monument. It's just like in the States. You can't go digging up ancient Native American burial mounds, can you?
They're sacred areas.
The sacred areas. Well, this is sort of like the same. You can't just go digging it up. You have to have permission. Now, we got the archaeologist, the county archaeologist who's responsible for that area on side. We got a team to do it. I even had, that there was even going to be the money to do it. And the problem was that English Heritage said no. Now, some people have come up with conspiracy theories. Oh, they don't want Arthur to be found because he was an alien. No, that's not the reason that they said no is because it's a good reason. They get dozens and dozens and dozens of applications all the time for archaeological digs, and they have to sort of look through them all one after the other.
Yeah.
But they very seldom give permission unless it's absolutely necessary. And the reason being, remember I was talking about these geophysics, ground sensing, radar and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Every year that kind of technology gets better and better, and it's believed that maybe in 10 years' time you won't even have to dig to be able to tell exactly what's down there. Once you've dug something up, you've destroyed the evidence of what these people would have eaten, how these people would live, what kind of clothes they would have had. And as archaeology becomes better and better as a scientific discipline, the need to dig might disappear. So they don't really like to allow digs unless they're absolutely necessary now, when there's a road going to be put through there or something, or when there's a building going to be put on top. So there's no conspiracy as to why they won't let us dig. But at the moment, I'm hoping that because of my book, so many people are going to know about this. They're going to have a dig, because otherwise someone's going to dig it up.
Yeah, you're going to have people going out at nighttime and digging the hill up.
Well, I was left in a rather awkward position of thinking, well, if I publish this, then people might mess it up. But if I don't publish it, it'll never be known.
Yeah, but you'll go crazy. You would go crazy if you didn't publish this.
I know. So I thought, well, let's just hope that English Heritage allow the dig to happen.
Well, for the listening audience, this is a wonderful book. Graham has filled it with some great photographs and pictures and graphs and things like that. And it's really quite a fascinating book. Boy, would it be amazing if the word got out that they had uncovered the remains of this Orwin, who is Arth, and here we go. In our last couple of minutes, Graham, is there any reference to any of the people that are figured prominently in his life, Gwendolyn, or you do mention Merlin in the book. Can we hear a little bit about what you discovered with Merlin? Because I think, you know, his the characters that support him are quite important, you know, especially Merlin.
Well, the interesting thing about Merlin, remember I mentioned this character, Ambrosius Aurelius, who seems to have been leader before him, an ex-Roman general. And then suddenly he's somewhere around 490. He suddenly like disappears from history. We don't know where he goes. He just kind of like goes. Remember the monk Nennius, the one who's the mentions all about Arthur's battles? Mm-hmm. He talks about a period just before Arthur comes to the throne, and he refers to Merlin. He actually refers to Merlin, but he doesn't call him Merlin. He calls him Ambrosius. Now, you say, well, if he calls him Ambrosius, why is he referring to Merlin? Why would you say Merlin? It's because in the Middle Ages, there was a legend that Merlin first met a British king called Vortigern when he had a vision of two dragons and foretold that these dragons meant that the Anglo-Saxons were going to invade and fight the British, i.e. two dragons. That was a story associated with Merlin in the Middle Ages. And Nennius tells exactly the same story. About somebody just before Arthur's period, but he doesn't say it's Merlin. He says his name's Ambrosius. So in other words, Ambrosius and Merlin seem to have been the same person. And what I speculate is that what happened is the real Ambrosius Aurelius had to retire. He was too old, maybe he was wounded or something like this, and became advisor to Arthur on Roman tactics, or advisor to Owen Thangwyn on Roman tactics and other matters, and therefore became known in the legend as the old wizard Merlin, who is advisor to King Arthur.
Wow. Fabulous. Fabulous. The book's called The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, The Search for Camelot and the Isle of Avalon. My guest today has been the author, Graham Phillips. Graham, this is a wonderful book. I definitely want to have you on in the future and talk about some of the other work you've done, but much success on this. And I think I don't want to say you've opened a can of worms, but I think once the world gets more information about this, I think there's going to be some interesting information revealed to the public. At least I hope so, because I think you've begun that preliminary research and investigation that is going to lighten up a lot of people's intuition and thinking of wanting to go out there and dig around and see what else is out there.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and thank you for wishing me the best. And let's hope I have opened a can of dragons.
All right, Graham, we'll be in touch. Much success.
Bye.